your patience. Hopefully the technical difficulties about streamlining will be resolved very shortly. And I can welcome not only Professor Baldwin here and you all in the room, but also people globally who can follow this lecture. It is a real pleasure for me to welcome Professor Baldwin on behalf of the London School of Economics Institute of Global Affairs, where I work as academic director. Before we start, as you know already, I have to see there is an obligation to tell you that because we are hopefully streamlining, but definitely recording this event, please put your phone on silent. But you don't need to switch it off, because we hope that you will be tweeting if you find the event interesting. And the LSC tweet is LSC Baldwin, and of course Professor Baldwin is an avid tweeter, and he has his own account, so you can put his LSC IGA if you want to be nice to us as well into your tweet. It is a real pleasure, again, Professor Baldwin and Richard, if I may, to welcome you. Professor Baldwin is the professor of international economics at the Graduate Institute of International Development Studies in Geneva. He's been there since 1991, if Wikipedia is to be believed, where he, as we know, most of us know, he's been conducting well-known research on trade, trade policy, trade theory, and the globalization as such. He is the former president of the Center for Economic Policy and Research, the CEPR, which I'm sure almost all of you will be very familiar with. He served there with distinction for 5 years, and maybe the institution brought up to a new level. And if I may add, actually his successor, and he must have had a hand in this, is an inaudible female economist. And he's tweeting about, you know, chief economists being now placed at the major institutions, and he is a big proponent of gender balance in this profession, which is not very balanced to date. Personally very grateful for that. He is a research associate also of the National Bureau of Economic Research, and has been elected twice as a member of the Council of the European Economic Association. During his very distinguished career, Richard has been associated with a number of top-rated universities, University of Oxford, MIT, beforehand the Columbia University of Business, and he's been working associated with leading think tanks. Just very recently, he was lecturing at Peterson Institute, and he also served there as on the board of that institution. And he's advised governments around the world and international institutions such as the European Commission, the OECD, the World Bank, the WTO, EFTA, and USCID. He got his PhD from MIT, but his master's actually from LSE, so it's really another homecoming of his, and his BA from University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's published, he's the author of a number of very important books. Most recently, and this is what you will hear, Globotics Upheaval. This is also on sale, as you of course will have noted, at the atrium. Before that, just a few years ago, 2016, he had a huge success with Great Convergence, with the unbundling extremely innovative, insightful thinking, thought-provoking thinking at the time. He's co-authored a number of other books, but I'm going to stop because you want to hear. But I would like to make one more point, because in addition to being a really originative thinker, which if you still already don't know, you will see just in a second, you will know that he is a phenomenal communicator and a truly innovative communicator of high-quality economics. He himself founded Vox EU in 2007, and he's been the editor-in-chief ever since. If you are a researcher, you know what it is. It is today unquestionably the global leader in public dissemination of economic research. This is where top researchers send their research in, written in a way that is accessible, is short. The turnover of publication is, as I have personally had the benefit of seeing this, the turnover is very fast, very thin, without any risk to the high quality that they entail. It's been a major innovation and really made a tremendous influence in policy making in Europe and beyond. So here today, and this is my last word, you have a man in front of you. He is an original thinker, a major policy influencer, and an activist organizer in that area. It's quite a unique combination of skills. So just friends here and online, prepare yourself for an intellectual roller coaster. Richard, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Perosky, for those very kind words of introduction. And thank you for arranging this setting for me to share some ideas with a very important audience. LSE, as you heard, is one of my alma maters, and I took classes, I don't think in this room, but definitely in this building, in the old theater, I took lots of classes. Let me start by explaining why I wrote this book. Now, many of you will be thinking, if the author has to explain why he wrote the book, it's probably a book the world could have done without. And who knows, maybe that will be your opinion, but give me about 30 minutes to try and convince you that there's something here. Now, this book was supposed to be a book about the future of globalization, which would have been completely in the line of development that I've been doing for a couple decades now. And it was based on that book that Piroska talked about, which was 2016 book, The Great Convergence, the last chapter of which talked about the future of globalization. And I had hundreds of conversations all over the world with all sorts of interesting people gaining all sorts of insights about the future of globalization. And this book was supposed to just write up those conversations. Quick, easy. But in doing the research for this book, the background research, I found three things that really bothered me and led me to expand the topic of the book. The first was, it's about services, not manufacturing. And there's a very systematic thinking that the future of globalization will be like the past globalization. And the past globalization was mostly about mining, manufacturing, and agriculture, above all manufacturing. And you'll see all sorts of discussions where they're using the past to predict the future, not realizing the future is about service globalization, where the past was about manufacturing globalization. A similar thing was that when people talked about robotics, they completely mixed up industrial robots, which are interesting but nothing new, and white-collar or software robots, which are rapidly affecting the service sector. That confusion is shot through the literature, it's shot through the media, and even in very careful books like The Second Machine Age by McAfee and Brynjolfsson, they will, almost in the same paragraph, talk about how AI is training robots with soft fingers to do things in factories, and then how service sector jobs are being automated. And that, I thought, was just wrong. Now, the second thing is that it's coming faster than most people think and in ways few expect, in part because they're using the past to project forward, and I think we're at a very thing. The third thing I've forgotten, but it was really important. I'll probably get to it when I'm talking. Okay, let me go to my slides and start with this one. The future's unknowable, but also inevitable. The reason I put up that slide is to remind myself and to remind you that tonight's lecture is about the future, which means, by definition, I'm making it up, because nobody can know the future. But even though you can't know it, you have an obligation to think about it, because it's coming no matter what. And I personally think people are misthinking on several levels the future of globalization and automation. And that's what I'm trying to get across here. So what I'm going to start with is just definitions. Globotics, an ugly but hopefully memorable word that smashes together globotics, Globalization and Robotics. And I think in a few years, the only thing anybody will remember about this book is that Baldwin also said digital technology is transforming globalization, not just automation. Now, every day in your news feeds and the newspapers, you will read about how artificial intelligence is automating this job or that job. It's all about automation, about robotics. But you almost never realize, read, that the exact same technology, digital technology, is transforming globalization at the same pace and affecting largely the same jobs. In other words, service jobs, not just manufacturing jobs. And so that's why I wanted to invent this ugly word, so people will remember it. And I have to say I've had about 15 reviews of my book, and I think half of them pointed out what an ugly word that is. So I think I'm kind of happy about that. Globalization. When I talk about globalization, I'm not going to be talking about all the forms of globalization. I'm going to talk about telemigration. And when I talk about robotics, I'm not going to be talking about the things you saw in the Jetsons or Star Trek or Star Wars. I'm going to be talking about software robots, which I call white-collar robots, to distinguish them between with steel-collar robots. Basically, they're software. Okay. Telemigration. People sitting in one nation, working in offices in another. And when I talk about this in business, it's very easy to get it across, but in more academic settings, people don't understand what I'm talking about, or they don't realize how pervasive it is, or they don't realize how fast it's growing. So I've brought 2 one-minute clips to show you in real life a couple of telemigrants. The first one is Joseph, and I'm just going to play the clip, so you have to read along. So just if you didn't notice that, the Kenyan government is training 1 million workers to join that labor force. That's the low end, simple task. Here's the high end. Is there some way to turn this up?
Zendesk is a cloud-based customer service platform. Currently we have engineering teams in Copenhagen, Dublin, and Melbourne, and Singapore. We have a large support presence in Manila. We had a need to build a team that focused on integration, finding people with very diverse skills and knowledge of other people's software. The market in the Philippines, in terms of developers, is basically owned by Upwork. Everyone is either on Upwork or Upwork curious. It's clear to...
So that's the high end. They're looking for programmers who know about software. So the low end... Simple tasks, a high end, and this is a threat for some type of office workers. This is a threat for more professional people, including potentially economists. Let me talk about the robots. So white-collar robots also come in the low end and the high end. The low end, most common, is called robotic process automation, or RPA. And if you don't know about RPA, look it up. Not now, but look it up on the internet. It's changing the world of work very rapidly. It's, in essence, one of the killer apps of the new machine learning. Now, this is a picture of the robot. Not very sexy, but if you can do a macro in Word or Excel, that's this. So, for example, I was in the US a couple weeks ago, and I sent an email to Swisscom to change my subscription so I could have a special subscription for calls within the United States. Somebody at Swisscom opened up that email, saw what I wanted, then opened up the subscriber database, changed my subscription, closed that, opened up the financial database and changed my billing, closed that. This thing does that using exactly the same tools in exactly the same way, but 100 times faster, and records everything, so if there was ever a mistake, they know it. And as long as it can get the original email down, it doesn't make any mistakes. So in essence, it's like a player piano. It's playing the piano exactly like the humans are doing, but just much faster. So that's robotic process automation. And many office jobs where people are essentially processing information, where the key element was that you could read or understand. Those elements now computers can do and are replacing those jobs very rapidly. That's the low end. This is a high end, white collar robots high end. This is Amelia. Amelia plays a very large role in my book. And you can't help but call it a she, but of course it's just a piece of software on a computer. And there's other ones, Watson from IBM, and a whole bunch, these high-end AI platforms. And you tend to persona. Most of them don't have such a presentational avatar as Amelia. And by the way, if I forget, there's a wonderful story between, at the end of the book, about Amelia and Amanda. Amanda is the human model on which Amelia is based. And I'll tell you at the end. If I don't remind me. Now, many of you by this point are saying, old wine, new bottles, automation, information technology, we've been here before, you've invented a few new words, what's different? And in doing the research for this book, I constructed some intellectual superstructures that helped me understand or convince me why this time is different, why really this is some breakpoint in the way the future is going forward. So, and let me spend the next few slides trying to share with you these intellectual infrastructure and see if it helps for you. First of all, as I mentioned, it's service jobs, not factory jobs. And office and professional workers are unprepared. Most of automation and globalization has affected people like this. If you told them the robots in China are coming for your job, they go like, it's been happening for 25 years. Nothing new. If you tell these people that they're going to face global competition, wage competition from those guys we saw in the videos, they won't believe it. And if you tell them they're going to face automation of their jobs by computers, they won't believe it. They're unprepared. Up till now, most service sector jobs have been shielded from globalization since services were considered non-traded. And they were non-traded because for many types of services, you have to get the service provider and the service buyer in the same room at the same time. And the technical difficulties of getting a service provider from one country in the room with a service buyer in another country is why services were largely non-traded. But digital technology is, in essence, making remote people less remote in all sorts of ways. So those technical barriers to trade in services are coming down at the explosive pace of digital technology, and these people are not ready for it. These people feel sorry for people in the north of England who've lost their jobs, or feel sorry for the people in Swindon who are going to lose their jobs in the factories. I think they will have a different attitude when they themselves start facing direct wage competition from abroad and automation of their jobs. Digitech is ICT. This is one of the things that took me a while to figure out. Everybody talks about digital technology now, and they used to talk about information and communication technology, and I wondered, well, what's the difference? The answer is nothing. It's the same thing. Moore's Law, Gilder's Law, Medcalf's Law, all those digital laws were applying before, they're applying now. But the big difference is that ICT was applied mostly to manufacturing, or at least as far as globalization and automation was concerned. So you had mostly physical constraints, with some bits of information and communication allowing organization that wasn't possible before. Now, Digitech is applied to services, which is mostly about information and communication and only a little bit of physical, and that means we're dealing with a different type of physics. Goods, the last 25 years, globalization and automation of manufacturing has been about goods, and no matter what, you could not violate the laws of physics that apply to matter. Now we're talking about information and services, which is primarily about electrons and photons, which obey a very different type of physics. It provides a constraint in our models. We don't model it, but it's in the background. So one way to see it is, how long would it take to double the flow of imports and exports in England? And the answer is at least 2 decades. Because you'd have to build ports. You'd have to build factories. You'd have to train new staff. You'd have to get lots more trucks and trains. Physical things take time. The flows of data between England and the rest of the world have doubled every 2 years for the last 10 years and probably will double for the next 10 years. 2 years versus 2 decades. If you are using the pace of globalization and automation from manufacturing in the last 25 years to think about what's going to happen in the next 3 to 5 years, you're using the wrong physics. 3, today's AI is different. AI is an old story, it's been up and down. Today, in 2019, computers can read, write, see, speak, understand speech, create visual output, recognize subtle patterns. Some of them can even speak as fast as me. In 2015, they couldn't do that. So what changed? The answer, in my mind, is programming is different. You many will be familiar with this book, Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow. How many people have heard of this? Okay, so psychiatrists, this guy's a psychiatrist but got the Nobel Prize in economics. They call it System 1 and System 2. He called it Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow. The basic idea is that humans have 2 ways of thinking. One is conscious, logical, effortful, difficult. It's hard to do 2 things at once. So if you're working out a 15% tip on a restaurant bill, you're thinking slow. And we know how we think slow. We know the steps. It's very logical. So we could teach computers to think slow. We could give them thinking slow skills. But we could not teach them to think fast. So thinking fast is you're looking at the iPhone video, walking down the stairs, you stumble, you recognize it's a cat in the video, catch yourself, having done a massively complex calculation to do that. You don't know how you did it. It was unconscious, and it was effortless and instantaneous. Now, since we don't know how we do all those things, catch our balance after we stumble down the stairs or recognize a cat, we could not teach computers to do that until 2016 or so. The difference is we were coding computer programs with logical code. Every single step had to be written down for every single situation. Machine learning is programming computers in an entirely different way. So what machine learning does is take a very large data set where the question is clear and the outcome is clear, and they estimate a very large statistical model, very complex, very nonlinear, using a variety of algorithms like neural networks or deep learning. They have different names for it. But for those of you who are econometricians, it's just data mining. And the thing is so complex, they don't know how it works. So in the end, they can recognize a cat in a picture with at least as much accuracy as a human, but they don't know how. They have all these statistical weights. It's very complex. But the guy, even the genius who programmed the computer or estimated this model, doesn't know what the program is looking at to see a cat as a cat. It just knows it's a cat. So the point is what, I mean, once the statistical model exists, you just throw up on a computer and it's another program. You put in some inputs, it runs through some steps, and out takes a guess. So in essence, we're programming computers in a radically different way, and that's why computers today have cognitive capacities that they did not have just a few years ago. And talk about why it was so recent. The fourth is digital disruption. One of the things that I found amazing about this whole world when I was reading is that digital technology is perfectly predictable. Moore's Law has been working since Richard Nixon was president. And the people over on this side of the room I can see are sort of closer to my taste in music. And maybe remember Richard Nixon. You guys over there, it was just after the ice retreated from Europe. In any case, it's predictable but unexpected. They even have a name for it. They call it digital disruption. And people, all sorts of companies have gone bankrupt. CEOs got fired. Universities have been taken by surprise. Lots of academics have been taken by surprise. And I'm thinking to myself, how is that possible that is predicted but unexpected? So this is a construct I made to understand that. So we have on the vertical axis progress, on the horizontal axis years, And I'm going to assert that humans instinctively think about progress in a straight line. And when I mean instinctively, when you think about, somebody tells you, half the cabs in London will be driven by autonomous robots in 3 years, you don't sit down and think slow about it and do calculations and engineering things. You certainly don't. You use your gut. You use your thinking fast brain. And that brain looks what has happened in the last 3 years and sees the increment and more or less extends to think that the next increment will be like the last increment. Because our minds evolved to track motion in a walking distance world where things didn't move very fast. So we tend to compare past increments with future increments, and equal increments means linear. But that's not the way digital technology works. Digital technology follows a lazy S-curve. It's exponential up to a certain point until you face diminishing returns. But this is the interesting thing. It goes slowly. It's doubling every 2 years, but it starts from a low base. So it's not very impressive for a long time until it is, and then it just explodes. So at first, our gut overestimates the impact of technology. You know, we landed on the moon, and then all of a sudden people were talking about colonizing Mars. Or they drove one vehicle in Las Vegas around in a circle. They said, oh my God, all the jobs in America driving cars will be gone. So we have a tendency to overestimate it to begin with. But by the same thing, our gut underestimates the impact later on, further out. And this is what I call the holy cow moment. It's predictable but unexpected. And in technology, there's a name for that. It's called Amara's Law. And in economics, we know it as Dornbusch's Law, which crises take longer to come than you might have thought, but when they come faster than you ever could have expected. And that's exactly this holy cow moment. This transformation is coming in ways that few expect. So let me just put the... I'm not going to have any time for history, but I'm just going to put this in context. In my view, the globotics transformation is the third major transformation of our economies since modern economies. So we went from the farm to the factory. The big technological breakthrough was mechanical powers, steam power and other things. The second started, in my mind, in 1973 when they invented the computer on the chip. So computerization got small enough to be put on robot arms in factories, and it did amazing things. And 20 years later, it did amazing things to globalization by enabling outsourcing and offshoring of all those things. So that went from the factories to the offices. And what we're going to do now is move from the service sector jobs to sheltered service sector jobs, jobs that are sheltered from artificial intelligence and telemigrants. That's the end of the story, what I'm going to get to. But what I'm going to argue is that this transformation won't be like the other ones. So if you're trying to judge whether this transformation is happening or not, and you're looking to the 1970s for automation and 1990s for globalization, you're going to start to make some mistakes. So here's a few points. First, think tasks, not occupations. Many jobs will go, but few occupations. So just think about farmers and tractors. Tractors change the nature of the occupation of farming. And it meant we needed fewer farmers to grow the same amount of food, but it did not replace the occupation. And this is one of those systematic misthinkings of artificial intelligence that I came across repeatedly. Two weeks ago, I was in Los Angeles, and a very aggressive journalist said to me, these four jobs, which one of them will still be here in 5 years? And the answer is, all of them, but those jobs will be different. That's the point. And people are thinking about AI, like, okay, an AI can now read and help a lawyer with some e-discovery, for example. And then people say, well, how soon will it be before it can do absolutely what the lawyer can do and, in fact, enslave the lawyer, and they'll become our overlords? You go through this narrative. And that's like asking, thinking like a tractor is a baby farmer. He's just like in elementary school, but eventually he'll graduate from high school and then university, and he will replace the farmer. That's not the way to think about AI. These are very specific tools that can do very narrow things very well. And maybe way out, if we make it there, they'll have general intelligence. But that's not what the geniuses are working on now. They're working on a tractor, but for the service sector. Second, it won't look like Janesville. No Mass and Unemployment, Rust Belt Style. So many of you will have seen this book. It won a lot of business awards last year, Janesville. It's a story of a GM factory closing in a small Wisconsin town, and then some of the suppliers also closing, and the misery that followed. Depression, suicide, poverty, people having to commute, leaving. It destroyed the community, basically. Now, a lot of people think that globalization and automation will look like that going forward, and they will be surprised, because globalization back then came by closing a factory. And you only had to decide whether it was China or the robots that did it. But the factory closed, you could see it, it happened. That's not the way it's going to come. I think it's going to come like this. How many of you have been in a setting like that? Now, that's what I call the iPhone infiltration. And I want to tell you, let me just back up a little bit here. So this, 8 years ago, did three things. It was a really good music player. You could have all your music on it, which was fantastic and good quality. It was a mediocre telephone with a very short battery life. I used to call it, I can't hear you phone. And it was a web browser. It wasn't much use because there was almost never wireless anywhere. I remember distinctly walking around airports looking for wireless to download my emails, even though I had the browser on this thing. But one improvement at a time, one innovation at a time, one convenience and cost savings at a time, it came into our lives and changed many things. It changed our family relationships. It changed our social relationships. It changed our relationships with the cities and how we find businesses and get around. It changed work relationships in a very serious way. But here's the thing. Nobody decided to let that happen. And for a long time, nobody knew it was happening. Because it was millions of unconnected, seemingly small, uncoordinated changes which eventually, after 5 to 7 years, completely transformed our communities and our work. I think that's the way telemigrants and white-collar robots will come into our offices and our workplaces. It will be one task at a time, one convenience at a time, one extra thing, one replacement at a time, done by very disaggregated people. No government report, no decision, not even at the corporate level. It'll be at the department level. But after 5 or 10 years, it will have completely transformed the way we work. And in the meantime, most people won't even know it's not just a series of twists and turns. And I don't know if there's any journalists in the audience here, but it's already happened in print journalism in London. It has both AI and RI have transformed that profession, and yet it happened very gradually. Okay. This is one industry where it's actually happened already, the information industry. This is from the BLS classifications. And those of you who know labor economics know we have very good statistics on separations, which are job destructions, and hires, which is job creation. And in the United States, there's 140 million jobs. 5 million jobs are destroyed every month, 5 million jobs are created every month. It's a huge churning. And so what happened here, if you look at the dark lines, this is the total non-farming sector. These are the separations. These are the hires. They're pretty much tracking. It was a good time there. In the information industry, which includes media, newspapers, movies, but also things like Google and search engines, what you see is that the separation rates didn't change much from the average. It's the hires that went down. So whenever a job was displaced, whatever reason, they didn't hire a new person. And over time, you're starting to see a big displacement in this particular industry. And this one started early because obviously digital technology is really important in the information industry. Three, job displacement is the business model. Tech is driving job displacement. Human ingenuity is driving job creation. So I was I gave a talk in Berkeley 10 days ago, and there were some AI geniuses in the audience. And I was when I said job displacement is the business model, they all go, yep, that's right. That's what we're working on. People want to become a billionaire in the next 3 to 5 years by replacing 10% of the nurses, or half the taxi drivers, or half the receptionists. That's the business model. They're using this machine learning to replace workers. Not create workers. Now, jobs are being created. but they're driven by human ingenuity. And I think at this point it's worthwhile talking about this kind of funny world we live in. At Davos, they call it the 4.0 thing. You know, you probably read about industrialization 4.0, and then they couldn't think of anything else. So this year it was globalization 4.0. But that's really just digital technology. And what's going on there is we live in a world where there's two types of growth processes. There's one, the normal one, where 5 or 10% growth per year is really fast. That's like booming. That might just be 2%. And then anything to do with digital technology, it doubles every 2 years, everything. So it's explosive. Things that were unlikely this year will be ubiquitous in 2 years' time. So just take, for example, this is an iPhone 10, and it's 2.5 times more powerful than the iPhone 6S, which came out in 2015. This came out in 2017. The iPhone 6S is 120 million times faster than the computer that guided Apollo 11 to the moon and back. So what that meant is between 2015 and 2017, the increment in processing power was bigger than it was between 1969 and 2015. That's the holy cow moment. And some parts of everything are being disrupted at that explosive pace, but lots of other things are going at the normal pace. And that the idea is that job displacement is being driven by digitech, human engineers driving displacement. So in essence, you can think of as the mismatch speed is the problem, not the direction. It's just the mismatch speed. So job creation versus displacement. Job displacement, this is the flip side of the creation, is going very fast. Job creation is going linearly. And what that means is that the pessimists assume we remain here forever. Some people, oh my goodness, everybody's going to be unemployed, et cetera, destroying all these jobs that don't get replaced. The optimists assume we jump here immediately, where there's all the jobs we need. I'm both, because I think we're going to have to go through the difficult parts to get to the good parts. Okay, I'm not going to talk about automation because you read about it every day and it's fascinating stuff. But I don't want to go there. The only thing I would say is think white collar robots, not steel collar robots. And somewhat annoyingly, almost all of the reviews of my book had a picture of a steel collar robot, even though the point of my book is don't look at those things. But it's almost irresistible to put that. We're just drawn to these things. In any case, so I'm going to talk about future globalization, which is telemigration, and I'd like you to think of that as remote intelligence, which is a correspondent of artificial intelligence. So artificial intelligence is computers who can do some types of thinking. Remote intelligence is real humans who can act at distance. Okay, telemigration. Wage gaps make it profitable. Digital tech makes it possible. So deep down, globalization is always an arbitrage. Whenever relative prices are different across countries, companies exploit those differences by buying or making a good where it's cheap and selling it where it's expensive. And since it's a relative price, it's automatically a return trip deal as well. People arbitrage price differences in goods. That was the first phase of globalization. Then they started arbitraging differences in knowledge per worker. That was the second phase of globalization with outsourcing and offshoring, where people taught China to do things they could never have done before. And the third phase is arbitrage on wage differences. Now, those other two have been going on a long time, so the price differences aren't that great. But if you look around the world, the largest systematic price differences are for skilled service sector workers, nurses, doctors, bookkeepers, accountants. Quite systematically, there's a difference of 10 to 1 or 20 to 1 between people doing fairly similar things, and there's no arbitrage on those wage rates because of technical difficulties. But those technical difficulties are being brought down by digital technology. I want to talk about four ways that's happening. First is domestic telecommuting. So many, many people in the United States and in Europe are telecommuting, you know, half day a week or day a week, or some people permanently. And what that means is that our companies are reorganizing the work to make it easy to slot in remote workers. They're adopting collaborative software like Slack or Trello or Basecamp or Microsoft 365. They're adopting the hardware they need to do the telecommuting, to do talking to the people. Could be telepresence rooms or just simply good Skype screens or whatever it is. And they're rearranging the structure of the corporations from silos like the accounting department, the finance department, to projects. And everybody fired after every project and reorganized. And that makes it very easy to slot in remote workers. So this domestic telecommuting, which people are liking, is in essence the slippery slope to international telecommuting. Because once they figured out that they can rearrange the work to slot in remote workers, it will occur to them that they can do at least some of those tasks for 1/10 of the price by getting Joseph or the people in the Philippines to do those things online. Now, remote foreign workers won't be quite as good as domestic in-place workers, but they'll be a whole lot cheaper. So what do you think is going to happen? The second is online freelancing platforms. So these will essentially be the container ships of the new globalization, if you will use the analogy. So these are matchmaking websites. The biggest one is called Upwork. It went public last year. It's worth $2 billion. They're processing over $1 billion of freelancing revenue per year. There's millions of people online in over 100 countries. And most of it is actually international. There's some domestic. But it's like eBay or Alibaba, but for services. You know, somebody has a good to sell, somebody has they want to buy. eBay puts them together so they find each other, underwrites the financial transaction, and makes sure the thing gets delivered with some sort of quality assurance. Upwork does that for services. And that's what you heard Upwork referred to in that one thing. And there's a platform competition in the U.S., Mechanical Turk, Fiverr. There's a new, you won't be surprised, there's a Chinese entrant into it called Whitmart. It's the English language version of a big one in China called Zubaiji. Now, these things are in essence how people sitting abroad will work in our offices. In fact, for Vox, I've hired a copy editor. And I won't tell you the story, it's in the book, but it was, you know, there's no way I could have ever found this person. But you find them, you manage them, you hire them, you pay them, and you can even fire them. You have a little button that goes, end contract. You know, and having been president of CPR, firing people is the hardest thing you ever have to do, except on Upwork. End contract. Anyways, I probably shouldn't stress that. Smile when I say it. But it was a terrible thing, actually. And also, by the way, just to sort of, you know, strengthen my bona fides here, this woman who was doing the copy editing, she was too cheap. So we insisted that we pay her more because it just didn't seem right. It just seemed ridiculously cheap. Okay, so advanced telecoms, I don't have to remind you guys here. At least the guys over here, you definitely know all about telecoms and how it's changing. It could take too long. We'll just leave it there. Now, machine translation is the fourth one. And that is the machine learning thing that's really important in globalization is machine translation. And if you have not tried machine translation in the last 6 months or a year, you have to try it because it's gotten incredibly good, at least among the major languages. The big breakthrough was that the UN put online millions of hand-translated sentences in the 6 UN languages, and the geniuses, first at Google, but all the other ones, trained enormous models to translate sentence by sentence, not word by word, which is why you start typing things in, it changes the translation in previous, because it's looking for the sentence to translate. So it's really good now. The point is, machine translation is no longer Star Trek. So how many of you watch Star Trek? Okay, how many of you watch Star Trek on TV? Okay. How many of you know what a TV is? you know, it looks like a monitor, but anyway, never mind. So it's on your cell phones, your laptops, your tablets right now. It's for free and incredibly good. Google Translate is the one I use. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. I got from Tianjin to Beijing Airport, talking in conversation modes with taxi drivers and train people. You talk in English, it speaks in Mandarin, they speak in Mandarin, it translates in English. And it's really good. Skype Translator, if you got the option, you can speak in English, and the person on other sides hears you speaking Spanish. They speak Spanish, you hear them speaking English. It's sequential, not simultaneous. Mm-hmm. YouTube can translate on videos. It's also Microsoft Translator on Outlook. In any case, my thinking is that this is all going to come to a global talent tsunami. hundreds of millions of talented low-cost foreigners sitting abroad will soon start to compete for your job in offices in Europe and America. And that's going to change things. If you remember, the 1990s was all about hundreds of millions of low-skilled labor joining the manufacturing workforce and thereby completely transforming the world of manufacturing. This, in the 2010s, will be hundreds of millions of service workers joining the service industry and thereby completely disrupting things. That's what puts the upheaval as the second word in my title. Okay, future of work. How much time do I have? 2 minutes. Well, the future's not that long, so that's good. Good news, jobs will appear. And in an audience like LSE, you've heard about general equilibrium, and you know things do clear eventually. It can get a bit messy. You know, if it's the 20s and 30s, we may have to work through another 20s and 30s. But eventually, the markets do clear, and everybody gets a job. But more, in fact, in the Great Transformation, it started back in the early 1700s. What we saw was people left agriculture. This is for the U.S. and the share of markets. And as the share of jobs in agriculture fell, the share of manufacturing rose up to about 1970 or so, and the service jobs were climbing the whole time. And then the second one, the services transformation, we left the factories, went to offices, manufacturing jobs fell, agriculture continued to fall, and services continued to rise. And this is the way it looks like in every country in the world. So we will eventually have jobs for everybody because human ingenuity is infinite. But the point is that when these guys in 1850 were leaving the farms, they had no idea what jobs they'd be getting. They didn't know there would be a pharmaceutical industry. They'd never heard of an electric fan or a car. So the point is, you can't know what those new jobs will be. But when they left the farm, they and the government knew what they would be doing in those factories. They'd be doing manual work that required more training than the farm. So everybody had mandatory education up to the level of reading and writing and doing basic arithmetic and showing up on time and obeying instructions, because that's what you needed for the jobs of the future. You didn't know what the names of those jobs would be, but you knew what you would be doing. And that's how I want to think about the future. Same thing when the service transformation happened. The ICT created better substitutes for people who work with their hands, and so they got hit by it. But it created better tools for people who work with their heads, so they benefited from it, but you needed a university education to make those tools work. So it was a skill twist. And although the nature of the jobs changed, there was plenty of jobs. Future jobs. This is how I want you to think about it. Globots will do what they can because they're so cheap. The white-collar robots, that's software. Infinitely, perfectly, costlessly reproducible, as much as you want, dying up and down. And telemigrants are not much more expensive and not that much more difficult. So if it can be done by an AI or it can be done by an RI, it will be done, the task. Not obviously everything, but the task will be done. We will do what the globots can't. So if you want to think about the future of work, you have to think about what globots can't do. And what always disturbed me is that the newspapers and media news streams are filled with what AI can do that we didn't know it could do. When in fact, we should be thinking about what they can't do and are unlikely to do in the next 5 to 10 years. So first, what can't AI do? McKinsey Global Institute had this insight and spun it out in a report in 2017. And what they did was they classified all the activities in U.S. jobs into these 7 things: predictable, physical, processing data, collecting data, unpredictable, physical, interfacing with stakeholders, applying expertise, managing and developing people. These 7 things. And the red bar tells you about what share of all the hours worked in the United States are spent on each of these categories. And the blue bars, they ask the AI geniuses how much of those tasks, they broke it down to a task level, could be automated using current AI. And you'll see it goes from 80% to 2/3 for these things, and it comes all the way down to 9%. So in essence, whatever the jobs of the future are, and we can't know what they are, we'll be doing a lot of this stuff. because AI will be doing all that stuff. And if you squint your eyes, you'll look at these are the most human activities. And there's a reason for it. I write about a lot in the book why computers can't do the most human things. But I don't have time to go into it. But basically, the jobs of the future will have to be doing things that are social, human, involving creativity, empathy, curiosity, applying ethics, dealing with unknown situations, managing lots of people, motivating people. These are things that you cannot gather a large data set on. Therefore, you cannot train a machine to do it. Therefore, that's what we'll be doing. So just to put that in a slide, structured data is the key limitation. So if you want to know what AI can't do, look to see what task in your job you could not get a structured data set for. And structured data set means the question is clear and the outcome is clear. So machine learning is a jet engine, but big data is a jet fuel. The question is which tasks can't be captured with data. So some of the things you do in your job, like say, take my job, grading exams is quite routine. And if I had millions and millions of data sets, I could get an AI to grade the exams. But lots of stuff I could do, like should we pass this PhD proposal? Each one is one off. There is no pattern. And it also, lots of judgment of the human. We could not get a big structured data set. And what I mean by that is you open up an Excel spreadsheet and you say, this is what I did, this was the outcome, it was good or bad. And what you need is a million lines in that of doing it. If you're talking about managing people, lots of times you come to a meeting, it's not absolutely clear what the meeting's about, or at least fully. And it's definitely not clear what the outcome was, but you made progress. That's something that can't be done by computers. So what can't RI do? Well, these are humans. And the skill range is everywhere. So the only thing they can't do is be in the room. So whatever the jobs of the future are, it will involve a lot of being in the same room with other humans or machines. Because to at least some extent, the telemigrants will replace the task which doesn't require you to actually be there. And again, look at your own jobs. Each of your jobs is a long to-do list of chores. Some of those chores you can do by email or even telephone calls or whatever. Some you actually have to be there to make it work. So whatever the future jobs will be will involve lots of those kinds of tasks. So, long-run future of the work is going to be more human, more local jobs. We'll all be richer, therefore hopefully we'll be more generous. So, good, no? Downtown Abbey, where all the bad work's done by the robots. And all we have to do is decide whether we want a gin and tonic or a beer after we wake up. You know, we're going to ride horses or write haiku poetry or, you know, moderate a divorce. You know, lots of jobs for us, but it'll be easier. The trouble is, we have to manage the transition. We have to get through this disruptive phase before we get to the good future of work. So conclusions, Globotics is coming faster than most think in ways few expect. It will create a better world of work if we manage the transition. The mismatched speed of job displacement and job creation is the key challenge. We can control the speed. It's our choice. So don't let people say, you can't stop this. You hear that a lot by many optimists. You can't stop the digital technology from progressing. But who cares about the digital technology? What we care about is the digital technology's implications for our economic and social lives, mostly jobs. And we can control the pace of job displacement through many, many regulations that governments already have. And if it becomes explosive enough, they could shut that down very fast. And hopefully it would cause all sorts of unintended consequences, but they can do it. So I'll just stop right there. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Richard. That was a tour de force, as I think I promised to you. And since we don't have that much time, I'd like to open up the floor for questions.
Sure.
If you agree. I'm going to restrain myself and not ask you my question, but I'd like to know a little bit more, maybe it comes out of questions at some point, on how the politicians will look at this managing the transition, because that's a very big question, and because of course we are in the midst of populist governments and backlash of those who are dislocated even under the current conditions. But let's park it and let's see. I will I would collect three questions.
Three.
So please raise your hand so I can see it well. 1, 2, 3. Kindly introduce yourself for the record.
Hi, my name is Babak.
We have a microphone, sorry.
Hi, my name is Babak from Regent Investment Management. My question was exactly about the politicians, with the outsourcing of service jobs and companies becoming so much more profitable and got populism on the rise at the moment. What do you see in terms of regulation as a move for politicians to confront this?
Okay, thank you. Yes, here and then, and maybe four.
The board I serve now, no longer affiliated because I'm retired. One thing that seems to be underlying a lot of your optimism is that you confessed, in fact, to be a general equilibrium theorist. Not all economists, of course, subscribe to that. The only consolation I get is if I end up in hospital, at least a night nurse will come and hold my hand for me.
Okay, thank you.
I also believe in Say's Law, but you're not going to like that either. So.
My name is Michael Moskowitz. Hello, I come from the shipping industry. I was listening very carefully to what you said, and my question comes from your right-hand side. So I'm making a contrast between the two examples you brought, or two of the examples you brought. The first one was the Swiss comm and the robotic exercise, which is very simple and straightforward, and whoever invents the way of dealing with that, you know, will become a billionaire in no time. And the other is shipping. People have been trying to make ships run with robots. And when you start to apply robotics to real life and the way the sea behaves and ships behave and cargoes behave and crews behave, it's so complicated that you'd rather have a crew on board than robotics running your ship. Thank you.
Thank you. And one last, perhaps.
Yeah.
I saw your hand.
It was just following on actually from the first question and the thing you alluded to at the end. By the way, my name is Michael Shee, and I work for a software company called Systems at Work. Do you think ultimately the politicians like Trump, who have tried to kind of remove the arbitrage by taxing companies who move all their manufacturing or their assembly overseas, mm-hmm. do you think ultimately they will be successful in removing this arbitrage, or do you think it is inevitable that we're going to end up in a situation where these jobs get lost to the overseas telemigrants?
Right. Okay, so let me just go through those. It was start with the politicians. So basically, I think a vast majority of politicians are not aware of how fast this is happening or living in denial. Was this famous quote by the U.S. Secretary of Treasury Mnuchin when he was asked, what did he think about AI? And he says, oh, the idea that AI would replace American jobs, that's 50 to 100 years in the future. And this guy made billions by forward-looking thinking. And lots of people just are unaware of it. Or actually, there's a difference between people who sort of study this and are a little bit behind, and people are actually at the cutting face. So I'll tell you a story. I have two sisters. One is a PhD labor economist at Princeton, and she thinks I'm just making it up and being sensationalist. It's not true. It doesn't matter. My other sister works for Rockwell, and she goes, oh, yeah, we're doing that already. Definitely. Mm-hmm. And there's just kind of disconnect between the reality. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of the politicians don't know about it. But there is a politician right now in the United States. His name is Andrew Yang. He's running for president, 2020, really a long shot candidate. But he is making this pitch his thing. He's saying the digital technology, blaming big digital tech companies, are automating our jobs or sending them overseas. Mm-hmm. And we got to stop that. Mm-hmm. Now, he has a couple solutions which aren't going to work. And he's not going to get elected, although he'll probably sell a lot of books, which I can definitely sympathize with. But other left-leaning Democrat candidates will find it almost irresistible to blame big tech for this anger in the United States. Not China and the immigrants, big tech. And it wouldn't take a lot for an Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders to slightly steer this discussion of why people think they were harmed or why they're upset, why are their jobs so precarious, and steer it towards big tech, which lots of people have problems with for many different reasons. And usually these upheavals are not just one thing. It's a whole bunch of things, and all of a sudden they decide it's this or that. So I think the politicians will latch onto it. We'll have a populist, well, at least we'll have candidates. We already have one, at least, populist candidate blaming Digitech for all the ills. So, but how they manage it, I don't know. The way I think there's really the way they should do it, the way they are doing it and will continue to do it for sure, and the way what I call the nuclear option. So option A is that governments let this rip, and then they help people readjust, because deep down all this is people having to change jobs, like they have had to do for the last, you know, since the 1700s, people have had to change jobs. Mm-hmm. It'll be a lot faster this time. But on the other hand, it'll be one type of service sector job for another type of service sector job. So in some sense, it'll be less disruptive. And, you know, countries like Denmark or a lot of the northern European countries, even the UK, has active labor market policies to help people adjust. That's the way we should do it. Let the technology rip. Let companies adopt the technology or outsourcing as fast as they want. But help workers. Protect workers, not jobs. That's plan A. It's probably not going to happen in the UK. Definitely won't happen in the United States. So plan B is shelterism, as I call it in the book. That is, people are so far, most people are not anti-tech. They just want a little shelter from the storm. And they're using existing regulation to slow down the adoption. So my analogy is Uber. And wherever the city is where the taxi drivers have been sufficiently politically powerful, they've used existing regulations to slow down this digital technology coming into the market. And the same thing is true in many places with Airbnb. And privacy, like medical records and privacy, are slowing down the offshoring. Sometimes bank secrecy and things are slowing down the data. And a lot of countries are using privacy rules to slow down some of these things. So shelterism, I think, will happen, but it'll be spotty because you don't have time to put in new regulation. So, and lots of jobs just are completely unregulated. The nuclear option is employment protection legislation. So if this thing gets crazy and, you know, all the white-collar workers from Paris join the yellow vest and start really causing trouble, so we get it like L.A. riot stuff, people will have to react very quickly. And governments, every advanced country in the world, has rules about firing people. It's called employment protection legislation. Countries do it differently, but they have it. Even in the United States, it costs you something to fire people, or it might, depending upon how you do it. And if they dialed up the cost of firing workers, the companies would implement the AI and the R more slowly. That's all there is to it. So that would have lots of unintended consequences. We would suffer for decades, sort of things that are going on in Spain with two-tier labor markets and youth unemployment. But if it comes to a social upheaval where the white collar joins the blue collar and we get some holy mess, they can slow it down. So that is something they may or may not go to. But so let's hope they don't. GE pessimist. So I don't know where to start with that. So I'll just end there. Shipping industries. So I'm so glad you said that, because there's some tasks that can and some tasks that can't. But I'm not an expert at shipping by any means, but I do believe that the ships are on autopilot at least some of the time when they're in the middle of the ocean.
That's underwater.
What?
That's
underwater. Well, it is, actually. No. So it depends what you mean by robotics, but it is a computer taking in inputs, deciding how to steer the ship or keep it on correct or the course changes because of the winds or the currents. That autopilot is also AI. Spell checking is AI. Mm-hmm. Optical character recognition is AI. Handwriting recognition, that's AI. So AI is basically any time a computer takes over some mental capacities. So some bits of shipping can be done by software or controlled by software, but certainly other parts, as you mentioned, can't. And what you mentioned was the most human things. Dealing with unknown situations, dealing with the crew, dealing with coming into ports and things like that. So I think that's exactly right. Now, if you allow me, I'm going to tell the story of Amanda and Amelia.
Yeah,
okay, so Amelia was this white AI platform. and they decided, this guy, it's done by IPsoft. And IPsoft decided to have this very presentational avatar to make it go. Is that one of its first appearances was in a Swedish bank called SEB, helping people open up bank accounts. So they had to teach Amelia Swedish. That took 2 weeks. It had to learn all the regulations of opening bank accounts. That took about 30 seconds. And then it started answering calls 1,000 at a time. Okay, Amelia. And funny thing is, it couldn't understand Northern Swedish. But anyways, that was a small... they're working on that one. But so Amelia is this amazing AI platform modeled on a real woman called Amanda Barnes. And as they do with games, you know, they take pictures and stuff. They make an avatar out of a real human. And as a publicity stunt, the owner of IPsoft got Amelia and Amanda on the same on the stage in New York at the same time, and they had a quiz show. So who do you think won? So, no, it was about general questions, and the audience judged that Amanda answered the questions in more natural language and better than Amelia. But if the questions had been in Swedish about opening bank accounts, Amanda would have been crushed. Now, I think basically companies around the world would be running competitions between Amandas and Amelias. And Amanda won because of her most human characteristic, which is she could deal with unknown situations. She could speak naturally about things she didn't know exactly, whereas Amelia hadn't seen it before, didn't know what to say. And that is, in essence, where you should be thinking about what parts of shipping will be taken over by AI or remote intelligence, which parts aren't, what are the most human tasks. So that was, I got my Amanda Amelia story, and I'm very happy about that.
Yes, please, introduce yourself.
So I'm Rob Clark from UCL. I was just wondering, does the robotics upheaval necessitate deeper economic integration agreements between countries? So do we need to do lots more service trade agreements in order to make it happen?
Okay.
I think I'm back onto the back of that. In so much that is the battle that's taken place between globalization and protectionism, because governments are trying to protect, and you're talking about globalization that has free reign. The Henry Ford story about how do you get union Jews out of the machine?
Right.
And the union man said, how do you get the machines to buy your cars? You know, if we make everybody uniform, there won't be the cash around to buy it.
Right.
Yes?
No.
No, okay.
Okay. So the deep integration agreements. The funny thing is I don't know if there's any trade nerds here, but this is called Mode 1 Services. And we have an international agreement called the General Agreement on Trade and Services, which went into force in 1994 and underpins this, all of it. And many advanced countries have already made commitments on Mode 1 in many different sectors and are open to it. So that's done. And we've also agreed not to tax digital flows, a moratorium. It was renewed recently in December last year. So the taxation of it is fairly difficult to do. It's even hard to imagine how it would happen. So no, we don't need any more international agreement to make this go. We opened up the floodgates in 94 because nobody realized what it could lead to, especially Mode 1. Mode 1 at the time was what the North sold to the South, and they sold to each other. So I think it's a very interesting thing. Where I think we will need some new agreements, and I think we'll probably get them, is on taxation and labor standards. So one thing is that these telemigrants, and I think this will be considered incredibly unfair to workers here, say in London, they don't pay taxes in London. And they certainly don't pay London cost of living. So for them, $5 an hour, that's a middle-class income in Philippines or Kenya or whatever. So that will be viewed unfair, but in particular, the taxation. So probably we will have to have some sort of agreement to make the taxation happen. I was in Davos about last month, and I talked to the CEO of Upwork, And I ask, well, what do you do about labor standards and taxation? And he says, well, actually, in the United States, some of their freelancers are in the United States, and they issue what they're called 1099, which is miscellaneous income for every worker in the United States, which means the IRS, in principle, knows about that income, so they should report it. And he said, but a lot of countries don't ask us, but if they asked us, we'd tell them. And so what I think we'll probably need is some sort of best practices among the platforms to report the freelancer's income to the local authority so that it can be taxed. And I was talking to an entrepreneur from Sri Lanka who was doing last mile services for Amazon deliveries because they don't have addresses everywhere. And so he was doing the end part. He said that everybody who has any IT skills whatsoever in Sri Lanka is working online and not in the Sri Lankan economy. For one reason, that they get paid reliably. Mm-hmm. But when you think about that, if that starts spinning up, that means major parts of tax bases in middle-income countries will disappear. And so probably we need an agreement to make sure that that doesn't disappear. The workers in the north will find it unfair that they're not paying taxes, and the countries that are doing it would like to get the taxes, so I think we might get an agreement there. The second one is about labor standards. So in trading goods, almost every trade agreement in almost every country commits to the minimum ILO standards. So, you know, rights to organize, no child labor, no slave labor. There's a few basic principles that they agree to. In the freelancing world, that doesn't exist. There's nothing. There's no, like, check that these people are over 18 or whatever the age of work is. And I'm quite sure that we will soon have a scandal like Nike did with the sweatshop. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that you saw with Joseph, they're doing a lot of it, they tag photos. So let's suppose you're Walmart, and one of the things they're doing is they're training robots to go through the aisles and take the inventory by recognizing all the stuff. Now, to do that, they need a big data set where everything in the store is tagged. Like, you know, this is a bottle of Hershey's chocolate, and this is a box of Wheaties, etc. And so they get people around the world to tag photos. And there are factories in, I've understood there are factories in China, shut down factories, where people are tagging photos very quickly for very little money. Mm-hmm. Now, one could imagine that some of those factories won't respect labor standards, and it may end up being underage people doing it. And eventually, Walmart will get egg on his face because they were essentially employing slave labor or child labor or something like that. And then we'll get some labor standards involved in this. So I think we need an agreement on that as well. There are other agreements that would facilitate it, like a worldwide database of equivalences of accreditation. So let's suppose you're in Nigeria and you get a bookkeeping certificate, like you're a bookkeeping certificate A. What does that mean in France, or what does that mean in the U.S.? And we could have some sort of agreements to make that work. So the globalization barriers are already gone, and probably we'll have to run after to get some things. Okay, the global protection versus protectionism. And you at the end of your question, you steered into universal basic income. So the basic problem there is, how do you get purchasing power into the hands of the people to buy the things the robots have made? That's the fundamental question. The cycling, when there's no jobs, that's the way it goes. So I have a series of reactions to that. The first thing is, it won't look like Janesville. So you won't see all these people put out of work. It'll look like what's happened to journalists in London. They used to have jobs with some security, some career advancement, a pension, a healthcare plan, maybe recreation, paid leave, and they got laid off or not rehired, and now they're still doing journalism, but in a precarious way for freelancing. So their salaries come down, they have no benefits, it's not clear that they can take anything off and not lose their jobs, etc. So first of all, the automation won't lead to a dramatic technological unemployment like Keynes had in mind. The second is, since it's going on in services, and services don't have, for most part, storage, the mismatch between supply and demand is much harder to get in services. So the robots make a whole bunch of cars, and then who's going to buy them? But when you're talking about, let's say somebody's doing a lot of web development. Who's going to buy them? The development and the buying are the same act. So this idea of the mismatch of supply and demand is systematically less problematic, I believe, in services than in goods. So that's one part of it. The last bit of that is, I think UBI, Universal Basic Income, is an interesting answer to the wrong question. Now, when you want to get the purchasing power back, you need to raise tax revenue. And we're talking like minimum 5-10% more of GDP we need in tax revenue. That's the hard question. That's what we should be asking ourselves. Where do we get that tax revenue? UBI jumps over the hard question and say, how do we spend it? And, you know, okay. Well, personally, I don't think UBI is the right story because I think people like reward. My thinking by analogy is what people do on the internet for free for likes. The amount of time people spend doing YouTube videos or Snapchats or Instagrams, they do an incredible amount of time, and all they want to do is be recognized for it. And if you just paid them $10 an hour to do mindless Instagrams no matter what, people wouldn't be that happy. So maybe you need some sort of basic living, but we already have that in Europe. I mean, people don't starve, and old people don't go bankrupt if they have a medical crisis. But you probably want more like a TripAdvisor thing in there as well. That you, if lots of people like whatever you do, whether it's writing poems or creating YouTubes or helping out an old, if somebody likes it, you get a little bit more. So that's the way. Or else Olympic judges. Like in academics, we put in research proposals, which are evaluated in a non-market way, and we don't actually get paid, but we're happy to get the money to spend on the research we like. And that's done by a panel of experts. It's not handed out equally, for instance. And so I don't think UBI fits with human nature, at least at the level that some people talk about it. So that's where...
Last round. Yes, please.
Very quick question, if I may. Chris Berg on financial services. I'm not from the academic world particularly, but obviously it's been a very reasonable argument that you put forward.
Thank you.
I've certainly been persuaded by it. I'm just curious about the disconnect between what's going on and the politicians. And it was raised slightly earlier, but I'm just curious as to what could be done to create a better conduit between your thinking and the politicians. Because the knowledge is there, the foresight's there, but what's happening? Well, so can we hand deliver certain of your books in all of the politicians through their letterboxes? How do we get them educated?
Yeah, please do. So let's not be flippant. But first of all, I think, what I wrote this book is because I feel like I'm ringing the bell in the village square. Like, wake up, this thing is coming. And all you have to do is talk to the other people around you. And I'm not making it up. It's actually happening. It's just they're not talking to each other and the politicians. I suspect that the populist politicians, the leftist populist politicians, will get hold of this and it will come up very fast. But, for example, there's no Ministry of AI, but there's a Ministry of Agriculture. Nobody is figuring out... there's a few commissions on the future of work, but they're kind of flaky and, you know... but systematically, what does this mean for how society will be, thinking through the technology, keeping on top of it? Government is completely left aside, and even lots of business are left aside. But many of the consulting firms are helping people avoid digital disruption, for example. But the politicians are woefully behind. I don't know how to do it. Let me put it this way. I've been in this business for 30 years. I first did something on the single market before the single market happened in the late 80s. And I had a solution, but nobody liked my solutions. They liked my characterization of the problem. And that's happened several times before with the euro, with the Eastern enlargement, it's happened. And when I was reflecting upon it, I think that academics are really brilliant at ignoring large swathes of reality, but for the right purpose. So the world is too complicated. You have to simplify to clarify. And the question is, what do you simplify to? And so you characterize, if you're lucky, and you've characterized the right questions, and people start thinking the problem through the perspective of your questions, and they come to different conclusions. But now, when you take the same guy and come up with the solutions, he's exactly the wrong guy for the solutions, because his solutions are based on ignoring large swaths of reality, which, as a businessman, you will know, is not the thing. Ideas are cheap, implementation is hard, And academics like myself are not good at implementation. So that's why I don't think they're listening to me. But anyways, that's thank you for the question.
I think that was a fascinating rounding up, fascinating last idea of what has been a truly transformational, as far as I'm concerned, lecture by Professor Baldwin. In the name of all of us here and the global audience, hopefully, with streamlining, I'd like to thank you so very much for accepting our invitation. Please do come back.
Thank you.
We want to hear the next book, the next big idea.
Sounds like I should do it at UCLA. UCL. There are so many people here.
No, just stick to me. We are happy to have friends from all over. But indeed, a great pleasure. Thank you for being such a wonderful audience. And again,
thank you very much.